time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Elliot Adams. Elliot Adams was a paratrooper in the U.S. Infantry serving in Vietnam in the 173rd Airborne Brigade, and later in Japan, Korea, and Alaska. He is past president of Veterans for Peace, secretary of Creating a Culture of Peace, and member of the training committee of Meta Peace Team. He is also active in his community as former president of his school board, former mayor of Sharon Springs, and former president of the local Rotary Club. From May 17th to August 4th of this year, he went on a 80-day, 300-calorie-a-day hunger strike in solidarity with prisoners at Guantanamo Bay and prisoners at Pelican Bay Prison Hunger Strike. Elliot, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Wonderful to be here. Thanks so much for all the work you do, Kate, trying to get the important information out to people.
So start out. Let's talk about your hunger strike in solidarity with prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. What were the incidents that led up to that?
Well, I really just started looking into it. I got interested in it, started looking into it, and began to recognize that these were people who had been picked up for a bounty. The U.S. government was paying $4,000 for Afghanistanis, $5,000 for Pakistanis. And those of us who have been in uniform in other countries know that you're working with interpreters. We have no idea what the truth is, but we only know what people were telling us. And we know that, I mean, I've always believed that when we were in Vietnam and other places, when we called an airstrike based on the information of the informant and the interpreter, I just wondered how many mother-in-laws we were calling airstrikes on, to use a stereotype. But so most of these people are actually literally the majority of people in Guantanamo have been declared by the U.S. government as being innocent. They have decided that they are free to be released, and yet that occurred a year ago, and most of them have been declared free to be released for two or three times before that. So here they are sitting there, and there seems to be no way out of what is actually a torture chamber. That's basically what happens in Guantanamo. No matter what words you want to dress it up with, that's what it is. And they see no way out of there except maybe in a pine box. And in a desperation to try to have some way of expressing their voice, they've gone on to a hunger strike, only to discover that the U.S. government, our men in uniform, have found one more way to torture them through force feeding. And force feeding is recognized by the American Medical Association, the World Medical Association, and international law as being torture. That is force feeding of a competent patient, a patient who can make decisions, which these certainly are. In addition, through their attorneys, we understand that they're using a larger tube than is normally used. I mean, this is a process where you take a tube that you push up somebody's nose back through their sinuses, down the back of their throat, down through their esophagus, and down into their stomach. And it's extremely painful under all conditions, any conditions. People have described it as being the most painful experience of their life. People have described it as feeling like a razor blade is being forced up through their nose, down along their sinus, and down through their throat. But we also know that guards are telling them that they're doing things deliberately to try to get them to stop force feeding because it's unpopular for the government. We have reports from attorneys that the inmates have said that they'll strap one person in a chair, take a tube out of them, and then stick the tube into another patient without washing it or without using new tubes. That they do it in front of them because what they're trying to do is they're trying to brutalize them. They're trying to force them to stop. So anyway, and then of course, just to add another insult to another injury, once they've been force-fed, they throw them in a dry room to let them lay there for a while so they can tell if they throw up or not, because if they vomit, then they do the process over again. And there's a whole lot of other additional things they're doing to the people who are force feeding, putting them back in solitary confinement, giving them particularly invasive inspections after they see their attorneys, denying their attorneys access to them by phone, they have to fly down, et cetera, et cetera. But that isn't the point, Mike. When I was thinking about what they're going through, in the middle of the night, I could just feel their pain in my bones, and I felt like I had to do something. As soon as you research what is going on down there, it's just too painful and too appalling not to do something. And I was faced with the choices of, what do I do? Do I cry? Do I go in my backyard and scream? I don't know. So I decided to go on a hunger fast in solidarity with them and join. There were several other people doing a hunger fast at the same time. Diane Wilson was, in day 30 or so of a water only fast. And it was, we know, and typically in water only, you die in between 30 and 60 days. Brian Wilson was doing a fast at that point. Since then, a number of other people have joined, to do these long-term fasts. Andreas Contreras, who is also a member of closegitmo.net, has been in a fast for 100 days or so. He's been force-fed. He's gone through the nasogastric feeding for demonstration purposes 5 times. Very painful, very impressive. But it's kept him going on his fast longer. And the idea is, people ask me, not people didn't ask me, but whenever you do a fast, you have to have any action, you have to have your ask. And I debated that, what should my ask be? And I decided my ask should be that people educate themselves. I felt if I use a more traditional ask, an ask that people are more likely to do, like call your congressman or senator, they might call once and go to sleep. But I felt that from my experience that if they educated themselves on what was actually happening down there, they couldn't help but be active. It'd have to be active. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to build a social movement. I believe that the only reason Gitmo is not closed, there's no good reason for it to have it open. The only reason it's not closed is because politicians are pure politics for politicians. For some right reason or other, they believe there are votes to be gained, support to be gained by keeping it open, and or that they're afraid of closing it will cost them votes. So that's a matter of changing public opinion. If we can build a mass movement of people, just people, of people who want Gitmo closed, they will close it. And they will close it so fast, it's just amazing. Because that's the way politics works. Just as they've created this crazy, insane maze of reasons why we can't let people go. I mean, it reminds me of my father used to say to me, Elliot, there's no problem so simple that a committee of 5 intelligent men can't make it too complicated to solve. And that's what's happening. We can't release them to their hometown because if we release them to their home country, either they'll be tortured or else they'll join with their buddies and create more terrorism or something. Oh, we can't release them to this country. I mean, they've got a maze of reasons. And now we have a 30 day after the agreement to release them, there's a 30 day period and we can't bring them into this country. We can't do this. We can't do that. It's all this maze of stuff, which is really hogwash. If they want to release them, the thing to do is release them. If you aren't putting them on boats and planes and getting them out of Cuba, then you aren't releasing them. So, I feel that they're finding reasons to keep them in there. But our job is so true in this country. I mean, if we believe this is a democracy or if we want it to be a democracy, there's only one way to do that. And that is for us to get active, really active in creating the government we want, making our government be responsive to us. We talk about a government of the people, by the people, for the people. It starts with by the people. We have to be active in our government. If we want Guantanamo shut, there's no point begging Obama to shut it. There's no point wishing our politicians would shut it. We have to build a solid grassroots movement which changes the public opinion, builds a public support for closing Guantanamo. Even Obama said it when he was elected. He said, "You have to make me do what I want to do," and that's what it comes down to. So I'm encouraging everybody to get familiar with Gitmo. A good place to start is coming to our website, closegitmo.net. We're about to rework it to try to make it even more a better organized for an educational tool. But if people will educate themselves, you can go to Witness Against Torture website, Center for Constitutional Rights website, find out about the prisoners and their look at their stories. These are very human people who got swept up and have been trying to make a living for their family, some of them in their home country, some of them across a variety of countries. You know, they're cooks, they're just people, and they're human. And find out about them. We talk about, the government talks about the worst of the worst, which of course is ridiculous. First of all, over half of them are completely innocent, and the government said so. But even beyond that, they call them the worst of the worst, and I'm going to tell you, anybody who could call them those guys the worst of the worst has never spent time in a U.S. prison, any U.S. prison. I mean, there's some really nasty people in those prisons. The people down in Guantanamo are mostly innocent. We know that. Some of the rest are organizers. And they may be warriors of some sort or other, but they aren't really sociopaths. And there's a lot of sociopaths in the, in prisons. I mean, I remember listening to a prison psychiatrist who was looking at some of the cases, and he realized there was this guy he had. And you can look at the record. Every time by accident they put him in a room with somebody else, he killed him. Well, the people in Guantanamo weren't like that. So I believe that it's time for us to get together and make a movement. And I'm asking you, as you listeners, to educate yourself on Gitmo and talk to your neighbors, talk to anybody about it. Put a sign on your car, put a sign on your window, whatever you're comfortable doing. You know, as Dr. King said, every man must choose the form of protest that best suits his faith, but we all must protest. And that's key to being an American citizen, is we all must participate in the government, make the government do what we want.
And you're looking at, if just for those people that are interested in the financial aspect of this, $2.7 million a year per prisoner, is that correct?
That's correct. That's the number we got out of the U.S. Senate hearing. They said $2.7 million, so I figure if the Senate says it, then I'll buy it. So you're looking at $2.7 million per person per year, so you have 86 of them we kept for 1 year after the third time they were declared free to be released. So that's $250 million or for, I don't know, you can do the math, 86 times $2.7 million. I mean, it's a hell of a lot of money. I mean, if they don't know what to do with that in Washington, I'm sure you could use it here in Seattle. We could use it in upstate New York. And then you have the other 2.7, you have the other 80, which they say they want to keep. I mean, this is like a pawn. They want to keep them indefinitely without charges. I mean, this is a violation of the Magna Carta, the habeas corpus from the Magna Carta. That's 1,000 years of civilized society has believed that that should be a basic tenet of law. And suddenly we have allowed our government to say that's not necessary. That's not necessary. Violation of the Constitution, speedy trial. I went through the Constitution, about five chapters of the Constitution is a violation of. Violation of the principles laid out in the Declaration. But anyway, so it's 2.7. So we have 80 more of them. They want to keep in indefinite detention without trial. So you will be paying $2.7 million per person per year for apparently indefinitely, maybe until they die. We could alternatively put them in a U.S. maximum security prison for $90,000. I mean, that's chunk change compared to the 2.7 million. And that's times 80. And then people say, oh, well, you can't put them in the U.S. prison. They're too dangerous, which is pure hogwash. If you took the Guantanamo patients and victims and put them in a maximum security prison, the guards there and the officials there would think you sent them a bunch of Girl Scouts. They are trivial compared to the people they have in a maximum security prison. Nobody has ever escaped from a modern maximum security prison in the United States. So that's not a risk. Everybody I've talked to in the areas around the maximum security prisons have no problem with bringing them in there. Now, I know our congressmen and senators are saying we can't bring them into the United States because people don't want them here, but that's hogwash. And in fact, not only could you put them in maximum security prison, the ones that you've released, there's some discussion about where to send them, and there are at least three cities that have said, bring them here. And I'm going to tell you, they can come to my place. I got 75 acres. We can feed them. And I've looked at their record. I'd be happy to have them as neighbors. I'd like them better than some neighbors I have. But it's just an appalling waste of money, besides being a complete affront to any moral principles. We've talked about torture. I mean, we know this torture is going on. We know torture has no useful purpose. I have talked to CIA officials. I have talked to FBI officials. I have talked to people in U.S. Army intelligence, military intelligence, and they, to a man, every one of them will say torture doesn't work for getting intelligence. The CIA doesn't even call them interrogation. They call them interviews because as a man who I talked to who felt that believes he has probably interviewed more people for the CIA and has done more trainings for the CIA than probably anybody else in the CIA. Hard to confirm, but anyway, that's his belief. He said the first time you raise your hand, you've lost your first time you raise your hand towards a person you're interviewing, you've lost it. You're never going to get any further. So we know that torture doesn't work. There's no evidence that it ever did work. Except for in the movies. And so why are we torturing? I mean, it's crazy. And it's certainly a violation of not only all the documents and principles laid out in this country, but also the principles laid out in religions. Whether you're a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew or a Jain, or et cetera, all those religions are certainly all the Abrahamic religions, which are based come from Abraham, call for, you know, the golden rule, as simple as that, you know, do unto others and forgiveness. We are just doing something totally opposed to those religions, totally opposed. Most of us came up with a religion training, and we still are doing, and many of us call ourselves Christians or Muslims or Jews or identify with some religion, and yet we're allowing our government to do what is diametrically opposed to them. We should close Gitmo because it's a violation of our moral principles, and as somebody last night said, when we allow torture in Gitmo, we allow torture in the U.S. prisons, which we also should talk about a little bit about. And when we allow torture in Gitmo and our U.S. prisons, we wind up changing the nature of American society. And we pay a price for allowing ourselves to stoop to those levels. And even if you don't care about that, surely you care about the money. I mean, we have budget problems. We all need money. And it's just appalling to be wasting money at that order for absolutely no reason. And there's also national security issues. I would dare say that Gitmo is the biggest single national security threat we have. Sure, there is China and things like that, which we might look at, but the reality is that in order to get somebody to attack another nation, you have to demonize the people of that nation. And for generations, it's been very hard to demonize the United States. Because we were held up by the world as being democratic. We were held up by the world as being fair and just. And now, if you want to attack the United States, if you want to demonize the United States, all you have to do is mention Gitmo. And believe me, in the United States, Gitmo we see as being a small thing, a little thing. If you go overseas anywhere, especially in places like the Middle East, Gitmo is bigger than the whole United States. I mean, everybody knows about it, and everybody's aware of it, and everybody's be pushing the issue. Indeed, I would have to say, I don't know whether Al-Qaeda is inclined to lobby, but I can guarantee you if I were in a hierarchy of Al-Qaeda, I would clearly hire a lobbyist in Washington to keep Gitmo open because it's tremendous for them. And people talk about the security risk of releasing them because they say these are the worst, and if we release them. I mean, I've had people who literally told me that, oh, yes, they're innocent, but because we treated them so badly, we can't release them because now they'll become terrorists. And I have to say, you have to ask yourself, who are you? I mean, that's a little bit like saying, going down your basement and discovering you borrowed your neighbor's electric drill, and, oh my gosh, I've had it for 3 months. I should have returned it, so maybe I'll just tell them it's mine, or I'll hide it, or I'll do something else. I mean, what would you do? You'd give it back to them, for crying out loud, and say, geez, I'm sorry. But I would say those who do feel that these people create a security risk because if you release them, they might become terrorists, I would say they're not seeing the forest for the trees. Because you have 80 of them down there, let's just say take the 80 or the 166, whichever way you want to look at it, who are being held, and each one of them has a whole family, extended family, and neighbors who are furious at the injustice of the U.S. holding an innocent person. So they all are potential terrorists. So by releasing the 80, you reduce the number of potential terrorists by probably 800. Because maybe they will. But let's just go to the individual people and say, what is the recidivism rate of them? Well, in 2009, 2010, I can't remember which it was, the Department of Defense rated that at 2.9%. Now, that's 2.9%, and I just parenthetically, I just want to note that in the U.S., the recidivism rate of people being released from prison ranges between 60 and 80%, depending on the state and depending on the year and so forth and so on. But that's 60 or 80%, so we're talking about 2.9%. And incidentally, part of the qualification for recidivism for being part of that 2.9% is if you speak badly about the United States, which is sort of appalling. So I think we have every reason to believe that there really isn't a significant problem releasing them. It makes sense to release them. More importantly, that we are better off for releasing them because we reduce the total number of terrorists, if that's what your goal is. And it's just crazy. It's crazy to keep doing it. There's no good argument for keeping them in there, and there's lots of great arguments for getting them out. And incidentally, I do want to just make a comment, which is for those who are willing to talk about people about how bad Gitmo is, it's also important to talk about why we are better off having it closed. Not just that it's bad, but also why we as a nation are in better shape to have it closed. It helps our morality. It makes us more secure as a nation. It saves us vast sums of money. It is the principles of the United States. As somebody has said to me recently, if we allow people to be put in prison and tortured with no charges and never allowed to see a judge to determine that or a court, why can't they do that to anybody, like you or me? We've suddenly crossed a barrier, which is a barrier which was fundamental in the formation of this nation, where we could all be put in jail. Right now, if the CIA goes to a library and asks for if the NSA goes to a library and asks for who's been taking out what books, the library is not allowed to say that they've been there. They're allowed to pick up U.S. citizens on U.S. territory by the laws they have on the books now, which say they're allowed to pick you up and nobody's allowed to say you were picked up. So we have that on the books and it can be implemented. This is all part of the process. It's part of the process of the American citizens becoming citizens, which means being active involved in your government. I speak that way after 15 years in elected public office, watching the political process and doing it. So we need to shut it down. I just like to talk briefly about the torture in this country, in our prisons. We have most famously the shoes, where we hold people in solitary confinement indefinitely, without any judicial review, without any court. Basically what happens is they go from one prisoner to another prisoner, and I say to a prisoner, if you don't turn in other people who are involved with gangs or there's evidence of involvement of gangs, then we will put you in solitary confinement. And so on the basis of a single accusation by another prisoner who's under threat of being put in solitary confinement, they're put in solitary confinement and held there for 10, 15 years. The UN Rapporteur on Torture says that after, we know from science, after 10 days, there can be permanent damage from solitary confinement, and therefore any more than 10 days, not 10 years, 10 days, is considered torture by the UN. And because of Gitmo, because of the stuff that came out of the Bush administration, for some reason or other, we seem to be condoning torture. Torture does not work. We shouldn't be using it. It's wrong. It's immoral. We all know it's immoral. We don't believe in that stuff. We've sort of sold the soul of the nation. The principles we believed in are being compromised by this idea that we can treat people wrongly. You know, a guy I was talking to said, well, don't talk to me about the Constitution because they're not American citizens and they don't deserve the rights of citizenship. Yet my recollection of the Declaration was it talked about inalienable rights. These are God-given inalienable rights. The things we said in the Declaration of Independence were that never mind the laws. These are rights that belong to people regardless of who they are or when they were or what king is over them or what the king says. These are inalienable rights. If we believe that, then they are inalienable rights, and they affect everybody. They don't just affect U.S. citizens. And yes, there are laws which should only affect U.S. citizens, maybe Social Security or things like that, which only affect U.S. citizens. But on the other hand, if a foreigner comes to this country and breaks a speed limit, we don't say, well, the speed limit only affects U.S. citizens. So I think that's a bogus argument. We need to come back to the days we were back, for example, when France gave us a Statue of Liberty, because we were a shining light. We were something the world looked up to. We were a country that gave the world hope, because the first time in the history of the world, the rabble had proven they could govern themselves. I mean, at that time, everybody thought, or the majority thought, that the rabble needed an aristocracy to reward the good, to punish the bad, to protect them. And we said, no, the people can govern themselves. And they can create freedom and justice. And whether that was actually created or not, certainly we moved in that direction, and we certainly moved well ahead of the general culture of the world then. And we need to go back to those days, when we can be proud of ourselves.
Talking with Elliot Adams, he is past president of Veterans for Peace and recently participated in an 80-day, 300-calorie-a-day hunger strike in solidarity with prisoners at Guantanamo Bay and those at Pelican Bay prison hunger strike. And again, people can find out more about this issue and your work at the closegitmo.net site?
Yep. And there's also an agenda on there of my schedule for this tour.
Because you're doing a West Coast tour.
Yep, doing a West Coast tour. Yep.
So from here, you're on your way down to Oregon?
Nope, Bellingham next, then Olympia, then Portland, then San Francisco, then San Jose. I did some around San Francisco earlier. And then I go on down the coast and then over to New Mexico and Arizona.
All right. They can get all those details on closegitmo.net. All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks so much for letting me talk about this. Thanks so much for helping people see the important issues and the reality behind them.
All right. Thank you. Again, Elliot Adams, former president of Veterans for Peace, and recently having gone through an 80-day, 300-calorie-a-day hunger strike. You can find out more about his work and the situation there at Guantanamo Bay and his upcoming schedule at the website www.closegitmo.net.
That's Gitmo with an I in it, too.
Gitmo, yeah. G-I-T-M-O.